Thank you, James. Good morning, everyone, and thanks very much to the Heartland Institute for inviting me here to present my thoughts on the subject of climate change.
But first, let me give you a little
thumbnail of where I've come from over these many years. This was my home for my first 14 years, a small logging camp on the northwest tip of Vancouver Island in the rainforest by the Pacific. I didn't realize how lucky I was. There's the town today, growing up, playing on the tide flats by the salmon spawning streams in the rainforest until I was sent off to Vancouver to boarding school, eventually finding myself at the University of British Columbia studying the life sciences, biology, biochemistry, genetics, a little forestry. And then in the mid-1960s, before the word was known to the general public, I discovered the science of ecology, the science of how all things are interrelated and how people are related to them. And in the mid-1960s, at the height of the Vietnam War, the height of the Cold War, and the threat of all-out nuclear war, and the growing concern for the environment, I was transformed into a radical environmental activist. I can't seem to get it to go that way anymore. I found myself in a church basement with a like-minded group planning a protest voyage against U.S. hydrogen bomb testing in Alaska. We proved that a somewhat ragtag-looking bunch, that's me under the P in 71, could sail a leaky old halibut boat across the North Pacific, help galvanize public opposition to the tests, and change the course of history. That turned out to be the last hydrogen bomb the United States ever detonated. President Nixon canceled the remaining tests in the series due to the overwhelming opposition we had spearheaded. On our way back from Alaska, we were welcomed into the big house of the Namgis Nation at Alert Bay, near my northern Vancouver Island home, where they made us brothers of the tribe. For this began for Greenpeace the tradition of the Warriors of the Rainbow. It's after a Cree legend that says one day when the skies are black and the birds fall dead and the waters are poisoned, the people around the world will join together to save the earth. We named our ship the Rainbow Warrior, and I spent the next 15 years full-time on the front lines of the movement around the world. Next, we took on French atmospheric nuclear testing in the South Pacific. France was still detonating hydrogen atomic bombs in the air in the early 70s, sending radiation around the world. They were a little more difficult. It took some years to drive these nuclear tests underground. And as late as 1985, under direct orders from President Mitterrand, French commandos bombed and sank the Rainbow Warrior in Auckland Harbor, killing our photographer. Going back again to the 70s, here I am driving a small rubber boat into the first encounter with the Soviet factory whaling fleet in the North Pacific in 1975. We confronted the whalers, putting ourselves in front of their harpoons and our boats to protect the fleeing whales. This got us on television around the world, bringing the Save the Whales movement into everyone's living room for the first time. Just 4 years later, factory whaling was banned in the North Pacific and eventually in all the world's oceans. Here I'm sitting on a baby seal off the east coast of Newfoundland to protect it from the hunter's club. I was arrested and hauled off to jail. The seal was clubbed and skinned, but this picture appeared in over 3,000 newspapers around the world the next morning. This and many other direct actions eventually brought changes to the way Canada manages its seal herds. Anyways, by the mid-80s, we'd grown from a church basement into a group with $100 million a year coming in and offices in 20 countries around the world. Presidents and prime ministers now spoke of the environment on a regular basis. But for me, it was time to make a change. I had been against at least three or four things every day of my life for 15 years. I decided it was time to try and figure out what I was in favor of for a change. I made the transition from the politics of confrontation, which is basically about telling people what they should stop doing, to the politics of trying to find consensus about what we should do instead. There is no escaping the fact that 7 billion people wake up every morning on this planet with real needs for food, energy, and materials. Sustainability, which for me was the next logical step after environmental activism, is partly about continuing to provide for those needs, maybe even getting a little more food and energy for people in the developing world, while at the same time constantly striving to reduce the negative impact caused by getting the food, energy, and material from the Earth's environment. Anyways, I could go on forever, but that's my story from the early years. Why did I leave Greenpeace after 15 years? When I began with Greenpeace, we had a strong humanitarian orientation to stop all-out nuclear war, to save civilization from destruction. By the time I left 15 years later, that's the peace in Greenpeace, of course, by the time I left 15 years later, Greenpeace had drifted into a position along with the rest of the movement as characterizing humans as the enemies of the Earth. And that was not for me. We are part of nature and from nature. Greenpeace also began to adopt positions I didn't agree with from a scientific point of view. Ban chlorine worldwide became one of the slogans. No matter how much I tried, it didn't matter that I was trying to convince them that chlorine is the most important element for public health and medicine, which it is. Adding it to drinking water is the biggest advance in the history of public health, and 75% of our synthetic pharmaceuticals are chlorine-based chemistry. Anyways, I had to leave because of that. And here, look at them today in the Philippines with a mask on in a parade, golden rice, which could help cure 2 million kids from dying each year, and they associate it with death in order to scare parents about something that can actually prevent their children from dying by the hundreds of thousands and millions every year. So that's where Greenpeace went, and I didn't want to go there. I'll just tell you about forests for 1 second because it's the most important thing, and it actually has a lot to do with climate. But wood is the most important renewable energy source in the world. It's the most important renewable material resource in the world. And it is the most important sequester of carbon in the world if you're concerned with that. And yet my old friends in Greenpeace are basically against forestry. In other words, opposed to the most important renewable resource in the world. We should be growing more trees and using more wood. Many activists argue we should cut fewer trees and use less wood. But this is the correct environmental point of view. But look at what Greenpeace does to this. Here's what the IPCC says. They're actually correct on this, except it takes them 38 bureaucratic words to say it. In the long term, a sustainable forest management strategy aimed at maintaining or increasing forest carbon stocks, that's what they call trees, while producing an annual sustained yield of timber, fiber, or energy from the forest, will generate the largest sustained mitigation benefit, means the best thing to do. In other words, they're saying, use trees instead of using steel and concrete wherever you can, and you will reduce energy consumption and you will be using something renewable. Greenpeace says, the IPCC says the easiest and cheapest way to fight climate change is to, quote, leave trees standing and protect its biodiversity, unquote. When I challenged this, the Greenpeace person said, oh, I didn't mean to put quotes around it, I was just paraphrasing. But that's a lie, too. It isn't a paraphrase. What the IPCC is saying is grow more trees and use more wood. 6 words. Of course, there are many opinions about climate change. There is the IPCC, which says... Sorry, well, how did that get there? That must have... Wow, yeah, that got reversed in the translation there somehow. Read the second one first. You know it all. It's extremely likely that human influence has been the dominant cause of the observed warming since the mid-20th century. Extremely likely. Does it make it more likely to put the word extremely in front of likely? They say yes. They say that means 99%, because very likely is 90%. And so they put percents along with adjectives that go with likely. What it turns out, actually, is that this is not a scientific word at all, likely. And even in the IPCC report, it says it's an expert judgment in the same paragraph as they say this extremely likely. An expert judgment is not a fact, it is an opinion. This is an opinion, so let them have their opinion, but they should make it clear that it's an opinion. Back up here. Whoa. Okay, start over again. Anyways, this is what... Wow, I got too far back, didn't I? There I go. This is what the Global Warming Petition Project, 31,000 scientists and professionals, all from the United States. This isn't even an international list, so much for your consensus. But I put my faith in the late Michael Crichton, who said, "I'm certain there's too much certainty in the world." And this is where this hubris comes in, this certainty that they are right comes in. And you cannot say you're certain that you're right when someone who's in authority is saying it's extremely likely. That isn't certainty. Anyways, we all know about this, and from here I'm just going to show you what I show people. Because you all mostly know this, but here's how I show it to people. First, yes, CO2 is increasing in the global atmosphere. But let's look at the last billion years of global climate change. I chose the most recent billion years. There is actually 3.5 more billion years of climate change before this. But we know pretty well that this is what has happened over the last billion. It's generally been warmer than it is today by many degrees Celsius. 22 degrees average global temperature has been the norm. But then there have been 4.5 ice ages during this period of time where temperature plummets on average down to 12 degrees, even 10 degrees Celsius global average. Today, the global average temperature is 14.5 degrees Celsius. We are in an ice age called the Pleistocene. That's why both poles are covered in ice. People don't understand that we are in an ice age now. This is an interglacial period within the Pleistocene ice age, and it is generally a cold time in terms of the Earth's history. Why are there 300 million people in the United States and only 30 million people in Canada? One word, cold. Sometimes I think that's why you let us have it. And you saw this graph yesterday in a different format, but anyways, it's the most recent 600 million years since modern life emerged during the Cambrian explosion, and it shows very clearly that there's no lockstep correlation between CO2 and global temperature. At times, they seem to be moving in a similar direction. In other words, there seems to be correlation sometimes, but as you know, correlation doesn't prove causation, and you'd need to see a lot more of a lockstep relationship. It seems that temperature is bounded on the top and the bottom, probably by a lot of feedback forces that are creating a maximum and minimum, and we're in one of those minimums right now. Yeah, it shows right there, for example, that now it's 14.5°C and CO2 is about 400, whereas the average over the last 600 million years has been around 2,000, which coincidentally is the optimum CO2 level for plant growth, about 4 to 5 times higher than it is today. That's why greenhouse growers purposely put the exhaust from their gas or wood heaters into the greenhouse to increase growth by as much as 100%. So we can look forward to increasing productivity in agriculture from increased CO2, as many of you know. Now, this to me is the graph, if you accept this is true, which it probably is something like true, because it has been warming for the last 100 years or so. The IPCC says that we've been the dominant cause since the mid-20th century. That's 1950. In other words, they do not ascribe the rise in temperature between 1910 and 1940, which you see there, to human-caused emissions, because we weren't emitting much back then. They only say it's the part between 1970 and the year 2000 that was caused by humans. Then what caused the rise in temperature between 1910 and 1940? Because it is identical in duration and size, 0.4 degrees over 30 years. They're both the same. It is not logical to be extremely likely that the second one is caused by us and the first one is caused by something else, which they don't really say what it is. So this, to me, demonstrates the logical fallacy of claiming that we are the dominant cause of global warming. Many of you have seen this. There has been no increase in global temperature for 17 years and 10 months and running. And then here is the United States for the last 10 years. The temperature has actually declined by a significant amount. And this, the polar vortex had something to do with this, I think. But no, I forgot, that was warming. That's right, yeah, I shouldn't make that mistake again. And here, of course, is the Arctic sea ice, which has right now is nearly 1 million square kilometers below its average since 1979 when we first started measuring it from a satellite. We have no idea what the extent of Arctic sea ice was before then, but somehow or other, Amundsen got through there with an 8-horsepower motor and a wooden boat in 1904. And the Canadian ship St. Roch got through there in 1942 or 4, both ways back and forth with a small engine, without a big icebreaker. So, what was it? Who knows what it was like back then during the heat wave of the 1930s into the 40s. And here, of course, is the Southern Ocean, where if you take the difference between the Antarctic and the Arctic, there is now nearly 1 million square miles more sea ice than the average since we started measuring it in 1979. And this is the sum total of our knowledge about sea ice. And apparently this is also due to global warming, the increasing extent of sea ice in the Antarctic, whereas the decreasing extent of sea ice in the Arctic is also due to global warming. So I get it. Everything is due to global warming. It's funny, but our children are not taught logic. They are not taught what the scientific method is. And they are taught that carbon is pollution. Oh, carbon dioxide, sorry. They're told it's carbon now, as if it was soot. This is sea level rise post-glaciation. The rapid rise in sea level all occurred between, really, 16,000 and 7,000 years ago, when the huge 2-mile-thick low-altitude, mid-latitude glaciers all disappeared. And since then, it's just been a very slow, gradual rise as more of the ice that was left in high mountains and the poles melts a little more, too. You saw this yesterday. This is tropical hurricane energy worldwide. Al Gore knows about this, yet he continues to say that it's going to be a devastation of the Earth from massive hurricanes. No such thing. And of course, you know that this is the longest period in the history of measuring hurricanes since a Category 3 or larger hurricane hit the continental United States. Right now, today, is the longest period we've known. So that one really, and even the IPCC does not subscribe to the belief that extreme weather events are tied to global warming, whether it's human-caused or not. They say there is no evidence of an increase in extreme weather events related to the warming that has occurred. And yet, Bill McGibbon and co, Al Gore, the whole bunch of them, perpetuate the idea that every extreme weather event is because of us. This is why we will never be able to predict the future of the climate other than about 3 days out, as John Coleman, who's coming up soon, will probably tell you he knows. It's because of clouds. Water, the most important greenhouse gas, is the only one that occurs in both liquid and gaseous phases in the atmosphere. And the liquid phase of water and the gaseous phase of water, which we call water vapor, behave in completely different way with regard to solar energy. Clouds can reflect the sun back, they can hold the heat in, depending on where they are and how thick they are and what computer model can predict the pattern of clouds in the world. It's impossible. That is why we will never be able to predict the future of climate, and clouds are the wild card, and many people believe that as the Earth warms and more water evaporates off the sea, it will be cloudier and wetter, and that will reflect more sunlight back. In other words, there will be a negative feedback against the effect of CO2, and that is just as plausible a hypothesis as the fry in hell hypothesis that we keep getting from the alarmists. As a matter of fact, it's probably a more plausible hypothesis. CO2 is the most important nutrient for all life on Earth. Please teach the children this. When we started emitting CO2, it was down to about 260 ppm. Now it's at 400. If it had gone down by the same amount as we've caused it to go up, plants would have started dying, because plants start dying at 150 ppm. Below that, and one of the reasons climate has, the CO2 has fluctuated during the glaciation we've had in the last 2.5 million years is because when the plants start dying, they emit the CO2 that they hold, the carbon that they hold as CO2, and then it gets better again. And so we've been skipping along on top of this low point for CO2 for a long time now, and it's about time somebody did something about it. James Lovelock, the father of the Gaia hypothesis, was an extreme pessimist about climate and said that humans are like our rogue species. He has changed his mind. He realizes that if Gaia is all one great organism, that maybe we're doing her bidding. It's like Carlin said, the reason people came into existence is because the Earth wants plastic. And maybe the reason people came into existence is because the atmosphere wants a little more carbon dioxide for the plants. Who knows? 88% of world energy. I'm just going to do a little bit of energy here, because especially to people concerned about human-caused climate change, energy is the flip side of the coin, and global energy policy is what they want to get their hands on, as if there's some kind of dial you can turn somewhere that is going to change the climate. They want to stop this 88% of world energy produced by fossil fuels, and especially the part where oil is involved, where there really aren't many substitutes, because that's transportation, getting the food into the stores. Hydroelectric produces 20% of global electricity, the most important and cost-effective source of renewable energy. Greenpeace and the rest of them are against it. They're against wood, the most important renewable in the world. They're against hydro, the second most important renewable in the world. And between the two of them on an energy side, it adds up to about 85% of all the renewable energy in the world, and they are against it, even though it's reliable, cost-effective, etc. Three Gorges Dam, Greenpeace succeeded in getting the World Bank to pull the funding from this. Thankfully, we buy enough flat-screen TVs from those guys that they could afford to build it without the World Bank, and they did. It replaces 40 coal-fired power plants, if you're worried about emissions from coal plants. It stops floods from killing thousands of people downstream in bad flood years, and it allows them to irrigate twice as much land. This is a sustainable development. And China, Canada, we up north get 60% of our electricity from hydro, but oh, they're against that. When the oil and coal and gas become scarce, this is what we're going to have to use. There is no question of that in my mind. So let's work on making it even safer than it is, which is already safer than every other major energy technology we have. 21 countries producing 15%. This used nuclear fuel that they want to dump in Nevada is actually one of our most important future energy resources. We know how to do it. Fast neutron reactors. The Russians have two of them running on the Caspian Sea. They just sold two to China last year. This is where we go. But we got lots of coal and oil and gas right now, and it's cheaper than doing this, so maybe it'll take a while. But you know what? In 300 years from now, all of the fission products in there pretty well will be decayed, and then it'll be just the good stuff left. So it won't matter if it takes 300 years before we start using that. But there is 5,000 years worth of nuclear energy in the 50 years worth of waste, so-called, that we've produced. Nuclear and hydro are the only energy sources that can effectively replace fossil fuels, if that's what you're worried about. These are too expensive for the grid. It's a sustainability officer in Long Island described solar panels as a wealth-destroying technology. Here's a cost-effective use of solar energy to heat water, especially in sunny places. And this is the wind energy going in the world. It's only rich countries, mainly China in Asia, and then there's Europe and North America putting all this stuff in. These are things that are going to be left rusting on the ground. Here's what happens with wind energy. One day you have 12,000 megawatts, the next day you got nothing. What do you do on the nothing day? Shut the schools, factories, hospitals, office buildings? Go home? No. You start a coal plant. That's what they're doing in Germany. In Germany, CO2 emissions and coal consumption has increased for the last 3 years running, while they call themselves the greenest energy country on Earth. In the United States, because gas is replacing coal, in some areas, CO2 emissions have gone down steadily for the last 5 years without any massive government intervention. Greenpeace's fossil fuel dilemma. Their new $32 million ship, they say it's powered by super-efficient electric motors and the wind. Powered by the wind. As if the wind is powering the super-efficient electric motors. Here they are protesting a coal plant being built on the shores of the Netherlands with all these wind farms around it. And Greenpeace says, you should be like us. You should power yourself with the wind. Don't build that coal plant. What's in the basement of that boat? Two big diesel engines. That's how they power the super-efficient electric motors. And if the wind isn't blowing, they have to fire them up. Or if it isn't blowing in the direction they want to go that day, they have to fire them up. This is called sail assist. And those windmills are wind assist for the coal plant when the wind is blowing. When it isn't, turn on the coal plant, just like Greenpeace turns on their diesel engines. Here's Greenpeace protesting a Russian oil rig with an oil-powered ship, saying we must end our addiction to oil. Is this hypocrisy? I think so. Now, let me just talk for a moment about something in my country that is being denigrated and demonized around the world, and that is the Canadian oil sands. And here's one of the upgraders there, which turns dirty bitumen oil taken off the sand. They are cleaning the sand in the world's largest natural oil spill. When the Rocky Mountains heaved up, the oil that was in deep formations flowed out into the sands of the former of the prairies, which is a former ocean bottom. And there it is near the surface now. But it's got to be cleaned up, just like a gas station when a little fuel leaks out of the tanks underground. You know, makes the oil in the dirt thing. It costs $1 million to clean one of those up. We're making a profit cleaning up the oil off the sand in Canada. Here's what oil sands mining in Canada looks like. It's a dirty business. It's true. It doesn't look too pretty when you open up the earth to get the sand out. But here's coal mining in the United States, which produces 15 times as much CO2 emissions as all of the oil sands in Canada. And I know that they're targeting this down here too, but that there looks like pretty good energy to me. Here's a map, Google Earth, showing the western half of Canada, therefore about half the boreal forest of Canada. They say that the oil sands is destroying Canada's boreal forest. You can see it there, barely. It's like a pimple on an elephant. And there's Edmonton, where you can see Edmonton down there too. When are they going to reclaim Edmonton? Or Las Vegas, for example. When are they going to turn this back into a desert ecosystem? Because in the oil sands, every square inch of disturbed land must by law be put back to a native ecosystem, as this piece has, as this tailings pond, which looked pretty damn ugly when the operation was going on, but once they finished with that tailings pond, they turned it into a bison pasture run by the First Nations Indian people who live nearby, getting $85 million a year from the oil sands in First Nations contracts. This is all reclaimed mining land. And so is this. And as an ecologist and environmentalist for over 40 years of my short life, this is good enough for me, and it should be good enough for everybody. Thank you very much for listening to me this morning. You can follow me on Twitter at ecosense.now. I have a big campaign going on golden rice around the world, and I think you'll find it of interest. I didn't have time to talk about it today. And we're talking about all the environmental issues there on EcoSense now, climate change, GMOs, nuclear energy, and all those topics. And I think you'll find it interesting if you're into following tweets to come and join the conversation with me. Again, thank you very much for listening to me this morning. Oh, I just wanted to mention one more thing. John L. Smith, if you are here, your Las Vegas Review Journal article is garbage. Thank you.
Good job, Patrick.
Thanks, James. Thank you. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.